This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus. Hello and welcome to Synchronicity. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we are speaking with Michelle S. Fondon. She is the author of The Wheel of Healing with Ayurveda, and she's here today to talk about her latest book, Chakra Healing for Vibrant Energy, Exploring Your Seven Energy Centers with Mindfulness, Yoga, and Ayurveda. I hope I'm saying that word correctly. And Michelle is the owner of the Ayurvedic Path Yoga and Wellness Studio, where she's an Ayurvedic lifestyle counselor and a yoga and meditation teacher. She holds a Vedic Master Certificate from the Chopra Center and has worked with Dr. Deepak Chopra teaching yoga and meditation. And her website is michellefondonauthor.com. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you so much, Marie.
Can you tell, I'm sure everyone after hearing that intro is going to be curious to know about your work with Dr. Chopra. So can you maybe tell us a little bit about that first?
Yeah, sure. So I studied at the Chopra Center and got my Vedic Master's Certificate there with Dr. David Simon, Dr. Deepak Chopra, and many other wonderful teachers through the Chopra Center. And once I got my Vedic Master's Certificate, we had the opportunity to work at Deepak Chopra's seminars as teaching yoga and meditation. So I did that and it was like really wonderful. But then after that, I decided to write for Chopra Lifestyle, which I did for 3 years. So I kind of did a whole lot of different things working with Deepak Chopra.
Cool. It sounds like a really amazing experience. So was that because he had, there was a Chopra yoga studio here in Vancouver for a while. I think it moved or closed, I'm not sure. But was it at one of those locations or was it at his main center?
It was with his seminar. So he travels to different locations with various seminars such as Seduction of Spirit, Journey into Healing. And so that's what I personally did. It's like 7-day seminars and 4-day seminars. And so I taught yoga in the morning and I would give people their mantras, their meditation mantras, and teach yoga in the evenings. So that's what I did.
Cool. That's really exciting. Thanks, Michelle. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that a lot of people have heard of chakras, but we might not know exactly what they are. I know that there's like the main seven, but right. In reading your book, you mentioned there's like over 88,000 chakras.
Right. So in Ayurveda, we refer to those energy centers as marma points. And so they're vortices of energy, or they're pinpoints of energy, kind of like what acupressure points would be for an acupuncturist. So these marma points, which are these energy centers, are very small and they're situated all over the body. And they're really good for energy treatment, such as like acupressure, acupuncture. In Ayurveda, it usually works with massage. So you're using these points or these energy centers doing massage therapy. And so that number is increased because of that type of therapy. But yes, you're correct. When most of us are referring to the chakras, we're referring to the seven main chakras.
Okay. And maybe you can give us a general little overview of what those seven main chakras are for people who don't have exposure to this.
Sure. So first of all, the word chakra means wheel or disc. And as I mentioned, they're vortices or they're spinning wheels of energy. And the seven main start from the base of the spine and they move all the way up through to the crown of the head. They align the spine. And the first chakra is at the base of the spine, the root chakra, Muladhara. Is the Sanskrit term, and that's our sense of having security and our basic needs met. Then we move up to the second chakra, Svadhisthana, our creativity and sexual center. It's above the pubic bone, but below the navel. The color is orange, and that is our creativity and sexual center. Then we move up the spine through to the area of the solar plexus, which is around the navel, around the belly button. Now, remember, one thing is that the chakras move from forward to backwards, so they do encompass the entire region from front to back. So most people, when they see chakra posters, they're only seeing the front, whereas the chakra disc or wheel goes transverse to the body, so it actually moves all the way through the body. So when you're talking about a region or area such as the solar plexus, it's moving from front to back and back to front. So that is our area of personal power and expressing yourself out into the world. the fourth chakra, heart, our source of love and compassion, is actually what links chakras of matter, the first three, to chakras of spirit, which are the last three. And so our heart is everything, right? It's our source of love, compassion, forgiveness, being able to have empathy and loving connections and relationships. It's also the center of our heart. So our heart, our lungs, our bronchial passages, some really vital organs sit there. Then moving up to the area of the throat chakra, that is called Vishuddha. And this is our source of verbal expression and speaking our inner truth, the inner truth that resides within our heart. Then we move up to the sixth chakra, Ajna, third eye, our center of intuition. And that color is indigo, and that is literally our third eye chakra, or seeing, intuition, being able to have foresight in not only seeing into the future, but maybe forecasting what your plans are. So if you're not into the more, if you're not into the more spiritual realm, it's more about being able to visualize things. And then we move up to the crown chakra, that is the seventh chakra, Sahasrara, thousand petal lotus, our source of enlightenment and spiritual connection. And that really is all about spirituality, but our spirituality, well, as to others, as far as having a more ethereal connection to others, but also to the universe and the divine.
Thanks, Michelle. Now, you mentioned a color associated with each of those. So what's the significance of the color? Because if you do like some kind of X-ray on the body or an ultrasound or something, I mean, these colors aren't going to come up. So how are the colors connected?
So the colors are actually seen in auras, in people's auras. So people that can see auras actually do see the colors of the chakras. But the chakra colors also represent different vibrational frequencies, and the visuals of those colors can actually be seen through the actual vibration of the chakras and what they're vibrating at. So if you think about it, the lower chakras vibrate at a slower frequency because they're more earth-based, earth energy-based. And as we move up, we get more into the spiritual realm. So it has to do with auras and the actual colors themselves, and also the vibrational frequency of each of the chakras, which can be really hard for a Western audience to grasp and think about. If you're not used to talking about these types of things, it's not something very tactile. Like you said, you can't see it in an X-ray or in a CAT scan. So if you want to look at it as something fun, you can just look at it is I'm going to wear the color of the chakra for the chakra I'm trying to heal, just as something fun or as a reminder, to remind myself to focus on that area of my body.
Interesting. Thanks, Michelle. So you mentioned you mentioned the heart chakra, and then you mentioned the third eye, and a question popped into my mind as you were talking about that. The Heart Math Institute has been doing studies on the heart's ability to actually predict things before they happen. And so I'm wondering, with that new research coming out, it almost seems like the heart is kind of like does the same thing as the third eye. I'm wondering if you're aware of that or have any thoughts.
The heart has its own intelligence. And I really believe that when we're really in tune to our higher self, when we're in tune away from our ego. So our ego self is always trying to look out for what's best for us, but not necessarily in our highest good, nor in the highest good of others. But when we turn to our heart center and we're really focused on that and in looking toward our highest good and the highest good of others and the highest greater good for the rest of the world, we're often able to find a better truth. And so, yeah, I firmly believe that. And it's interesting because I was listening to speaker Tony Robbins, who had said, you know, before we even have a brain, before we're even thinking, our heart is beating. And so our heart has its own intelligence. And I thought that was so beautiful because I never thought of that before. Of course, I knew it. I've had three children. I know the heart beats first. But it's really neat when you put it in that perspective.
Wow. When does the heart start beating? I don't know a lot about infant development
or embryonic development. I think it's day 16. I'm not sure. It's day 12 to 16. It's pretty early.
Wow.
So it's usually before a woman knows she's pregnant.
Wow. So all of that stuff that's going on before you even realize you're pregnant,
mm-hmm.
the heart is...
is beating.
Is taking in, and yeah. Interesting.
Amazing.
Ah, I like that. Cool. Well, we are talking right now with Michelle S. Fonden. She is the author of Chakra Healing for Vibrant Energy, Exploring Your Seven Energy Centers with Mindfulness, Yoga, and Ayurveda. And you also have another book that came out fairly recently called Enlightened Medicine. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So Enlightened Medicine, Your Power to Get Well Now, is a book about integrative medicine. So here's my premise, and the chakras fit in very much with this premise too, is that there are 150 million Americans. Now, I know you're in Canada. Canada probably has a statistic that's very close to this one, but 150 million U.S. citizens that suffer from at least one chronic illness, and that these are chronic lifestyle illnesses. So if you don't count infants and you don't count small babies, that's roughly half of the U.S. population that has at least one chronic illness.
Wow.
When we speak about this, this is type 2 diabetes, obesity, hypertension, which is high blood pressure, heart disease, certain types of cancer, stroke, anxiety and depression, addictions. Like, these are all diseases that are directly preventable through lifestyle changes. And Western medicine does not have the solution to these chronic lifestyle illnesses. But if you integrate the two approaches, the ancient wisdom of Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, yoga, meditation, different types of ancient healing systems, if you integrate that with Western medicine, you give the patient a lot more choices. And I think that it's so important to me to get this message out, because so many people are frustrated with their health and with what Western medicine is bringing to them and making them even sicker. Because once you start on one prescription pill, it's inevitable that you'll have a second and a third and a fourth, and they all have side effects. And preventive health and curative health is really where we need to be looking.
Totally. Yeah. If, I mean, Western medicine is great if you get like strep throat or something and need antibiotics, mm-hmm. that can literally save lives.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of good things that have come about it, but a lot of Western medicine, I feel like, has also kind of encouraged us to neglect the preventive aspects of our health because we figure, oh, we'll just take a pill for it.
Mm-hmm. And that works, like you said, with the cases of bacterial infections or in acute cases. So if you have an asthma attack and you don't know anything about any other types of medicine, and yes, of course, you want to go get to a hospital or get on a respirator or use your inhaler or whatever. I had kids that grew up with croup, which very much mimics asthma. And, you know, and I understand the importance of rushing your kids to the hospital when that's the case, or stage 4 cancer, things like that. But chronic lifestyle illnesses are very much preventable and very much reversible, and you need to know how to do it. And I think the problem is that most people don't know the how. They understand bits and pieces of the how. Like, we all know we're supposed to exercise more and we're supposed to eat less and eat healthier, but doctors are not necessarily taught in med school how to do preventive cures. Doctors are not taught in med school preventive measures to help their patients through lifestyle changes. And I think that's really what's needed today.
And thanks, Michelle. And also, like dietary recommendations, it seems to be, and there's always new research coming out, that it's not one size fits all. Like, some people do better on a vegan diet. Some people do better on a more of a meat-based diet or a ketogenic diet, and it's not going to be the same for everybody.
Yeah, and that's what I love about Ayurvedic medicine. So in the Chakra Healing book, I do talk about Ayurveda and how to help heal your chakras through Ayurvedic medicine. And of course, my first book is all about Ayurveda, which is mind-body medicine from India. And it does divide people up into mind-body types so that the diet and the cures and the preventive measures are all based on your mind-body type versus one size fits all. And that's really what I like about it, because I thought when I found it, I was like, this is so neat, because I know, for example, for me, and I tell the story about growing up in the 1980s, and when I was a teenager, as many teenage girls want to lose those last few pounds or fit into those skinny jeans, they want a diet. And the big diet fad at that time was a fat-free diet. Everything was fat-free. They encouraged you not to eat any type of fat. Well, for my mind-body type, that didn't work. I got really, really sick on a fat-free diet. So, you know, it's when I discovered Ayurveda that I said, oh, that's why I was so sick on a fat-free diet. Because for my mind-body type, I need more fat and less sugar, certainly. But having a fat-free diet just didn't work for me.
Thanks, Michelle. Yeah, I remember that fat-free craze. It's still kind of out there. And then they replaced the fat with sugar to make it taste better because, yeah.
Right.
So it's this whole big thing. And then everybody starts getting diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And
yeah,
it's a whole cycle. Yeah. But we do the best that we can with the knowledge that we have at the time. I mean, at the time, that's right. What people thought was the right thing to do. So that's what they did.
Yeah.
So I'm curious what kind of illnesses, you mentioned diabetes and chronic illnesses and stuff. What kind of success are you seeing with this Ayurvedic approach to actually healing and rejuvenating people?
Well, it's amazing because Ayurveda has been around for like 5,000 years. And I always move toward, I have an inclination to move toward a healing system that's been around for thousands of years because it's tested and true. I try to move away from fads because fads, especially in the Western world, the fads tend to come and go within, you know, several months to a year. And so the thing with Ayurvedic medicine is that it really works in concert with the body to get to the root cause of the problem. Once disease has developed, your body is already so out of balance that your body has been giving you signs and warnings for years. And so a disease doesn't just happen. And when you learn an Ayurvedic approach, or even in Chinese medicine, it's the same way. When you learn that disease does not happen overnight, you can take measures really early on to start reversing that disease. So in the beginning for Ayurveda, for example, we start calling it imbalances. It's not even disease by then. It's just an imbalance. So when your body starts giving you these little notions that something isn't right, and you feel that something isn't right, like you wake up in the morning and you're just like, oh, like I'm feeling sluggish yet again, and I really don't understand why. I don't know why. And you go to your Western doctor and they tell you, like, there's nothing wrong with you. We've run all the tests and there's nothing wrong with you, yet you feel that something is off. So the things that I've seen as an example is, I'm a yoga teacher. I teach a lot of yoga breathing techniques, pranayama breathing techniques. And I've had clients come to me with hypertension, like hypertension for a long time, where they've had high blood pressure, they've been on medications, and they started practicing meditation, started practicing yoga breathing, and they were off of their high blood pressure medication within months. So I've definitely seen that. I've seen people reverse anxiety. So they've had, you know, general anxiety disorder. They've been on medication for anxiety. And through these practices, through modifying their diet and into an Ayurvedic lifestyle diet, again, yoga, meditation, exercise, mindfulness, visualization, I've seen them reverse where they're no longer needing to have anti-anxiety medications. I've seen people, this sounds like really silly, but I do think in the Western world, we do suffer from a lot of like tummy problems, gastrointestinal problems. I've seen people with chronic constipation reverse that completely when nothing else worked, even medications didn't work, reverse that through Ayurvedic medicine. So, you know, I've seen it a lot. Like I've seen a lot of reversal of lifestyle diseases just by practicing those things. But it's what it's about. It's not this magic cure. It's not a magic pill. It's because you're actually digging deeper into the core issue rather than just masking the symptoms with a pill, with something, with surgery. So instead of doing that, you're actually getting to the root cause.
Thanks, Michelle.
All right, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna do it wrong. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay, okay. Wait, hold on. Does this make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we. You're not even gonna last. All right. Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France. Montreal, what the f***?
It's a script.
I couldn't even, what? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France. What are you even saying here? Oh, you're trying to say these are the things featured in this one. You should probably specify that, because even a fucking elf couldn't understand that, okay?
Think you can do better than an elf? At CITR, we want to have a variety of voices on the air. Want to write scripts? Do some voice acting? Broadcast your creativity? Volunteer with the CITR Production Department. No experience? We can also train you in everything required. Send an email to psas@citr.ca to learn more. And don't wait to get your voice on the air.
If you're one of the millions of Canadians who experience depression, anxiety, or some other form of mental illness, there's a free course that can help. The Wellness Recovery Action Plan is an evidence-based program that works. It's developed and facilitated by peers who have experienced their own mental health challenges and have used RAP to recover and maintain long-term stability. It's based on the key concepts of hope, personal responsibility, education, self-advocacy, and support. For more information about the free RAP groups hosted by Vancouver Coastal Health, visit their peer-led website, spotlightonmentalhealth.com. We are speaking with Michelle Fondon. She is the author of Chakra Healing for a Vibrant Energy. You can find her website at michellefondonauthor.com. And yeah, you mentioned the idea of when this has happened to me so many times. I've gone to the doctor, and at one point I was around 30, and I was in so much pain. I had so much inflammation that I could barely move. Like, I felt like I was 80 and not well at 80. I mean, there are people at 80 that run marathons. I was not feeling like that. And I went to my doctor, and she was like, "Well, you don't have arthritis, so I don't know what to tell you." And that was it. There was no discussion about what are you eating. There was no discussion about anything like that. And I managed to reduce a lot of that inflammation through diet on my own. But I had zero support from my doctor. She did one blood test and sent me on my way. It was like, well, you know, essentially it's all in your head if it doesn't show up in the three tests that they do or whatever.
In the tests, yeah. That's so crazy, but it's true. And here's the thing, in enlightened medicine, I talk about the history of medicine and why Western doctors think the way they do today and why they practice the way they do today. And it's basically the fact that integrative approaches to medicine, such as in the olden days, olden days, before Western medicine really developed, which was only about 250 years ago, it's very young. In the grand scheme of things, Western medicine is very, very young. So, you know, up until about 250 years ago, a doctor was a lot more intuitive in nature. So they had to rely on a lot of diverse approaches to help a patient. Now, they didn't have the advanced technology that we have today, but they did have to rely on a lot of intuition. So they had to look at, like, what is this person's emotional state? What is their family life like? What are they eating or what aren't they eating? What is their socioeconomic status? And, you know, are they having problems with money, income, job, children? Like, they had to look at a whole host of things in order to help diagnose a patient because they didn't have the things we have today. And so they were a lot more intuitive and they knew how to treat a patient a lot more because they didn't have, like, just a blood test and they could rule out yes or no. And, you know, the fact that our pharmacopoeia up until 250 years ago was herbal medicine. That's all we had. We didn't have any of these synthetic drugs, but they worked very well. And so, you know, and we hear about these big widespread disease in a lot of cases, such as the Black Plague and things like that. But we need to keep in mind that the reason why people became sick fast is because they didn't have good sanitation. So a lot of it had to do with hygiene. And once hygiene was cleared up, people got sick a lot less, and they still had a fairly decent lifespan. So I think the key is to keep our modern knowledge in science and the great things we've accomplished, but also to delve back into the past and kind of learn from the doctors of the past. And, what did they do in the past? But unfortunately, that has to start in medical schools. That can't really start with us. And that's why I'm all about educating my readers to, things that they can do to be their own physician, be their own doctor, so to speak. And, you were your own doctor when you were trying to change your diet based on your symptoms.
Thanks, Michelle. And yeah, I don't want to completely bash Western medicine. I don't want to discount. There's definitely value in a lot of what's come about with all of the science. And a lot of the science now is kind of backing up some of the more ancient and traditional healing modalities as well. But even things like diet, even with the blood tests that are done, as far as nutrients in our bodies and blood sugar, unless it's already within the red. So if I go to the doctor and I get my blood sugar tested, I actually found out that I was hovering on pre-diabetic blood sugar levels probably for a while, but because it didn't go into the red, the computer didn't notify and give it a flag, so no one told me anything.
Yeah.
It was only actually until when my blood sugar got up to a danger zone was when they told me. Well, by then that was years of accumulation and me thinking that I had been doing the right thing all this time.
Yeah.
Having no idea.
And that's another thing that Ayurvedic medicine teaches is that being healthy is not the absence of disease. Being healthy is a dynamic integration of feeling fantastic, symptom-free, and an integrative mind, body, spirit. So if someone says they're healthy just because they're symptom-free, but meanwhile they're really high stress because of a high stress job, you can rest assured that the disease is building itself up. It's doing push-ups behind the scenes, even though it may not show up on a test. So I think it's more about learning how to monitor yourself in a way that you're doing a self-check each and every day. Am I managing my weight? Am I eating, 9 servings or more of fruits and vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables per day? Am I eating whole grains and staying away from white stuff? Am I eating at times of the day where I shouldn't be eating? Am I just munching at night because I'm bored or depressed? just constant self-monitoring is just looking to yourself and saying, let's learn about, a healthier lifestyle. And am I managing my stress levels? Am I good in my relationships? Because unfortunately, we're just not taught those things. We're not taught those things in school. We're not taught those things in general in society. And like you said, it's not necessarily monitored through testing until it gets into those danger zones.
Michelle, I'm curious also with Ayurveda and the integrative medicine, where does community come into involvement? Because I noticed in our Western world, I picture when you said, munching at night because we're depressed is we come home from work, we sit in front of the TV or the computer. We may, even if we live with other people, we kind of, a lot of us in the Western world kind of socially isolate ourselves in our little computer or TV or cell phone bubble. And, in days gone by, people in the evening would sit around the fire and create music and tell stories. And I bet they weren't munching.
Yeah. And I talk about that actually in the book Enlightened Medicine. I have a whole chapter on emotional health, and I made the focus on emotional health on loneliness and our need for human connection, because that is a real problem. One of the 7 deadly chronic lifestyle diseases is anxiety and depression as the mental portion. And like more people are depressed now than ever. More people are on anti-anxiety medication more than ever. Addiction as a byproduct is a really huge problem in the U.S. and globally. But mainly in the U.S. and Canada, I believe, is we consume like 99% of the world's consumption of hydrocodone, which is Vicodin, is that medication, Vicodin, that painkiller. And 99% of the world's population of that, that's crazy. But what we're doing is we're medicating ourselves because we have so much pain, and this pain is mostly emotional pain. And I really attribute that to this increased sense of isolation that, yes, we have greater communication today because we can instantaneously communicate with our friends and family via text and FaceTime and Skype. But in our day-to-day lives, you know, I see people waiting in lines now on their phones, where we used to talk to people in line when we were waiting to buy concert tickets or waiting at the grocery store. You know, you'd strike up conversation with strangers. And now everybody's just on their individual phones. And I really believe that has a huge impact on health. And also studies have shown that it has a huge impact on health.
Yeah, even just those casual human interactions with strangers have an impact, a positive impact on our physical and mental health.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And we don't do that. Yesterday, I was about to get into an elevator and it was really full. And so I waited for the next one because I knew, like, I just felt how awkward it was going to be to be standing in that packed elevator. And which is kind of interesting how now we feel more and more awkward around people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because.
It especially happens with millennials now. I think the millennial generation is a generation of children and young adults that they have a hard time communicating with others in the way of when they're in front of a screen, when it's texting and talking and chatting over social media, it's a little bit easier. But when you get them face to face, like, just making conversation. And I'll give you case in point. I was in Boston with three of my kids, two of which are 24 and 20. And I'm trying to make conversation with this server and, you know, trying to just ask for things. That's all. And they're still really embarrassed. They're like, oh my gosh, you can't ask for things. Like, you can't talk to them. You can't bother them. And I'm like, it's a restaurant, you know what I mean? It's like, that's what they're there for. But it's just this almost social anxiety of not being able to talk to people outside of their devices. It's really bizarre to me.
Well, I find for me, I'll have headphones in a lot of the time. So I'll be listening to like an audiobook or a podcast or something. And or I'll be reading something interesting on my phone, and then a real human being will want to interact with me, and I'm like, ugh, now I have to like interrupt what I'm doing because I get so focused and sucked into what I'm doing because it's really interesting and our brains want to be interested.
Yeah.
And then I have to change focus and make small talk with someone who, you know, because small talk is generally boring. It's a person wanting to connect, but so few of us now have the skill to actually have an interesting conversation. So it's so much more interesting to just keep my headphones in. And then and then it just perpetuates this cycle of loneliness.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's really important that I mean, and I don't know what the actual solution is. Cyber psychologists, yes, there is a subsect of psychologists called cyber psychologists. Cyber psychologists have studied this, that the addictive qualities of being on social media, on being on your phone, on having that instantaneous response and those likes and those thumbs up and those feedback from your photos on Instagram and Snapchat and all that, like, it has an extreme addictive quality to it because there is instantaneous feedback. And so it becomes this pleasure center feedback loop that we literally become addicted to. Whereas when you're with another human being having a conversation, that feedback is not so instantaneous, because sometimes there's reflection and the person has to think about things and there's hesitation and there might be some confrontation, and it's not as pleasurable to our pleasure center as the instantaneous communication or the instantaneous whatever it is, even if it's the games on the phone. But when my kids were growing up, we did something called TV Free Week. And that was huge back in the 90s. But now I don't even know how that would work, because now we have every single device under the sun that could potentially be like a TV. So I'm not sure, but I think it's worth exploring.
Camping with no Wi-Fi.
Have a screen-free week. Yeah.
That actually, what was the thought that came to mind when we were talking about? Oh, yes, with the addictive nature of likes, I actually read that there are some social media companies that will withhold likes because what happens, and I notice this, if I post something and I don't get any likes, I immediately start to doubt what I posted.
What you posted? Yeah.
Was this bad? Did someone get offended or whatever? And just as you were talking about the addictive nature, I was reminded of, oh, that might not even actually be happening. It could be the platform itself withholding those likes to increase anxiety, which is increasing the addiction.
Oh my gosh.
I know, right? That's scary.
It's really, really, really scary. I mean, and you know, my son and I were talking about this. We went out for a Mother's Day brunch, and I was seeing these very small children. Now, granted, my children were born really before there were handheld media devices. They had like Game Boy and Game Boy Advance, but other than that, there really wasn't a whole lot. And I'm at this restaurant seeing these very small children. We're talking about ages 3 and under on their parents' cell phones watching movies while they're with their parents. And I'm like, wow. I'm like, it's really crazy how the socialization of kids is really like, I don't know how parents are teaching them to be social in a formal setting or semi-formal setting, like sitting at a restaurant, when it's such an easy way to just give them the phone and put on a Netflix, you know, cartoon or something. And Matthew, my, you know, 20-year-old millennial, said, don't judge them. They're just probably trying to manage the best they can. And I said, it's not a question of, like, they're trying to manage the best they can, because I know what it's like to be a parent of a toddler. It's more like a question in my mind. Like, if I were to go back to that time and have had an iPhone, would I have done that versus, like, try to appease my child with some crayons and paper or something, or reading them a book? So it does bring about a lot of food for thought.
Well, and it's really, I mean, probably if those things were available back in the 80s or the 90s or whatever, we probably would have used them because it would have been so common just the way it is now. So it's not so much a matter of judgment, but it is creating a problem. It helps in the moment, just the same as us standing in line. We feel discomfort, so we pull out our phone while we're standing in line, and it appeases that immediate discomfort. But what it does is it actually creates the habit of immediately needing to appease ourselves, not reaching out for social connection, which would have a better long-term benefit. And then it creates this feedback loop where it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah.
And I think that's the same for, you know, with if we take a pill. So we have this discomfort, or I'm having anxiety, so I take a pill for that.
Yeah.
Rather than sitting with the anxiety and feeling it and working through it, or asking my body what it needs, I could just take a pill, or I could eat a cookie, or I could surf the internet.
Yeah. And I was talking, so I've worked a lot with addicts and addicts in recovery. And I heard one line, which I loved, from a man who had been in recovery when I spoke with him for 3 years. And, you know, he's a young guy. He's like 34. But he had spent most of his young adulthood from, age 17 through age 30 as an addict. And he said to me, you know, in the past few years, I've been learning how to live and be okay with discomfort. And I thought that was so profound because it's true. It's true that, like, we don't like it when we're uncomfortable. It's terrible when we're uncomfortable. And so, you know, the whole fact of being able to live without an addiction or live without, like you said, grabbing that cookie or eating a pint of ice cream when a boyfriend breaks up with you, you know, it's being able to sit with that discomfort, like sit with it, become friends with it, you know, even in insomnia. So I had some emotional upsets recently, which I never get insomnia. Like, I am sleeping soundly every night.
Nice.
But I did have some emotional stuff going on, and I had a couple nights, you know, in the past month where I just couldn't sleep very well. I had a very fitful sleep, and, you know, and I was like, wow, I can understand how people would take pills for this, because this really sucks, knowing that you have to get up the next morning. And I thought, you know what, it's okay, though. Like, you know, I put it in perspective, and I said, you know what, it's okay, because maybe I just need to learn something from this, and I need to learn how to manage my emotions and what's going on right now, and it's actually okay. So I kind of allowed myself that, you know, but then I have this training and everything, but I can see how, you know, dealing with discomfort and being uncomfortable, even in pain, but pain has a message for you.
East Africa, as well as tuition fees, families must find money for uniforms, including shoes, textbooks, calculators, dictionaries, pens, pencils, and more. For poor rural families earning the equivalent of $2 to $3 a day, this is often an impossible challenge. Will you help educate bright, very poor Kenyan youth to help them find a road out of poverty for their families? Just $50 a month will allow that to happen. Gifts of smaller amounts can be combined to give youth a chance through KEEF, the Kenya Education Endowment Fund, a registered, BC-based, volunteer-run educational charity. Tax-deductible receipts are available. Donations make great gifts for Christmas, graduation, anniversaries, promotions, etc. Gift cards are available. More information at www.kenyaeducation.org, or you can call us at 604-415-9397, day or evening.
We are speaking right now with Michelle S. Fonden. She is the author of Chakra Healing for Vibrant Energy, Exploring Your Seven Energy Centers with Mindfulness, Yoga, and Ayurveda. And her website is michellefondenauthor.com. Well, and what we're really talking about is the difference between mindfulness and being comfortable with discomfort and distraction. And yeah. Ego. And it's almost, I mean, it's a product of our society, because I know that it's getting worse and worse, I think. But when I was growing up and I was a teenager in the 90s, I would see on television and I would see in magazines that there's a certain way I'm supposed to look. There's a certain way that my life is supposed to look. And it's not supposed to have any discomfort in it. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be sparkly. It's supposed to be thin and beautiful and rich, and everything is supposed to be perfect. And if it's not perfect, then that's a really big problem.
Yeah.
And what that says about me is that I'm a failure.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's getting more and more. I mean, now people are famous just for being famous. They're not even famous for actually doing anything.
That's true.
They're famous because they're able to stir up drama.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I agree. And you know what's funny is that along that thread, so let me just tell your listeners here, I owned a yoga business, a yoga studio, for 7 years. I've owned my business for 10 years. I've published two books with a publisher, which a lot of people dream about for years and years and years and years. And the other day I was sitting with myself talking to my mother after this reflection, saying, like, you know, I'm really kind of a failure.
Wow.
Okay, yeah, me. And I really do feel that way, but it was because I didn't feel that I had reached a threshold that I expected of myself or society expected of me for the age that I'm at, you know? And it's like, where in the world did I get this notion, you know? And where in the world did I get this notion of just because I'm not a high power executive at a Fortune 500 company, or that, you know, I have $1 million in the bank or whatever, you know, like somehow society got into my head that if you didn't have all of these things, you know, a solid retirement plan and all of this, that you were a failure. And so I really had to like put things into perspective and write about this and really say, like, it's not what society expects of you. It's that, like, we're all here on a journey and we're all here on different journeys, and we can't even compare our own journeys. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like everyone's on a different trajectory. So it's impossible to compare. And, you know, I was a stay-at-home mom for many years, and I'm really proud of that, even though I don't have anything monetarily to show or nothing to put on a resume to show for that. I'm really proud of that. And so I think if you're listening and you feel the same way, or you feel like you started your career late, or I know a lot of millennials are really grappling with, they've got this degree now. They got a degree from a four-year university, and maybe they even have a master's degree from a four-year university. But the biggest problem millennials are having now is finding an actual freaking job.
Yeah.
So they're winding up working as managers at Starbucks, which is great, but I can understand that sentiment, that feeling of, you know, my next step should be this because society dictates it.
Well, and that's even, I've had this thought so many times, and we could go on about this all day. We're running out of time, but it's such an interesting conversation, is if people are having trouble finding a job, then doesn't that mean that all the jobs that need to be done are being done? Like the idea that we have to force ourselves to create busy work,
right,
in order just to keep a roof over our head seems mm-hmm. so silly to me. Not that people should just not contribute to society. I'm not advocating for that. But that, do we all have to work 40 or 60 or 70 hours a week at doing something that we don't like just to buy pills to treat the anxiety that we have because right. we're doing something that we don't
something
like?
We don't like. And, you know, that's a really good segue into what I talk about when I talk about like living your life purpose. And I do talk about this in a couple of my books, that, and I was talking again to my children about this weekend, that, you know, I really believe that regardless of your degree, whatever you majored in college and you got a degree in, that, you know, I'm always a big supporter of living out your passion and purpose. Like, find your passion, find your purpose. And it doesn't have to be something huge. Like you said, becoming an instant star on YouTube, you know, for making one popular video or something. But just finding your passion and purpose, that we need more of people in the world that are actually entrepreneurial in spirit, but because they're living out their passion, because they're living their purpose, and that are happy at their jobs, because we will benefit from that in so many other ways. And go out there and find your passion. Even if you can't do it as a career right away, your health, as a general rule, will be so much better for it.
So, Michelle, you also mentioned, though, that even with, it sounds like you are living your purpose and living your passion, and yet you still have days where you feel like a failure. So
yeah.
what do you do about that?
Well, I think I just go back to meditation, and I go back to listening to my inner voice. But, you know, one thing that I started to do, and I haven't done it quite nearly enough, is that, you know, there are negative in everything and there's positive in everything. So I tend to just listen to clients that have given me great feedback about what I'm doing in my business, and, you know, my readers that leave me nice notes. And so I try to focus on that rather than focusing on the negative. And I think that's one way that you can move toward what it is that you feel in your heart is the right path for you, is to just focus on the positive, focus on your own inner strengths. And that's what I try to do. I just try to focus more on the positive, less on the negative, and move toward that. And that keeps me going, definitely. And, you know, a lot of prayer and meditation. I'm a really spiritual person, and I really believe in the power of prayer and the power of meditation. I've been meditating since 2007, and I would say to all of you listening that if there is one practice I would recommend to start, it would be start a meditation practice, any kind. Just start it today.
That's awesome, Michelle. Thank you so much. And I'm curious if maybe you could share briefly what your meditation practice looks like, because I know, like, this big word, and everybody's got a different way of doing it.
It's huge, yeah. For me personally, I do a mantra-based meditation. It was taught to me by the Chopra Center. It's called Primordial Sound Meditation. It's based on your birth date, birth time, birth place. So it's a little bit astrological in nature. So the mantra that's chosen for you is based on your astrological sign through Vedic astrology or Indian, East Indian astrology. And it's a silent meditation, so I practice it 30 minutes in the morning and 30 minutes in the evening in silence with repeating a mantra. And that is the best type of meditation that I personally have found as far as meditating. I love guided meditations. Sometimes I listen to guided meditations. I love walking meditation. Some people say they get a lot of meditation out of running, for example. But I think nothing replaces a sitting quietly doing nothing but meditating type of meditation. And that's what I embrace.
Thank you. And then it also, Michelle, sounds like you do the mantra meditation 30 minutes in the morning, 30 minutes in the evening. But mm-hmm. you mentioned when you have this discomfort or these emotional things that happen, it mm-hmm. sounds like you might meditate in a different way looking at that.
I do. And I also, so I do a lot of visualizations. I do a lot of affirmations. And that's something I've just picked up over the course of the years. You know, it started with my journey with Deepak Chopra, and it obviously developed with other spiritual leaders that I call them, and other authors. And it just sort of developed into my own thing. I think our mind can tend to be a very negative vehicle for moving you in directions you don't want to go in. But you have the power to control the mind. We don't think we do, but we actually do. You're the orchestrator of your own thoughts. And so in order to do that properly, affirmations and visualizations are really important. I mean, if you walked into my house, you would probably laugh because I have posters everywhere with visualizations of what I'd like to see manifested in my life. I've got affirmations everywhere in my room, in the kitchen, everywhere. There's affirmations all over the place. So, yeah, I think those are other meditative ways that you can change your mindset and just help you focus more on what you want out of life versus what you don't want.
Thanks, Michelle. And you mentioned that you've been meditating consistently since 2007, I believe you said.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
How long did it take for you to notice that you had more control over your thoughts?
Well, I will tell you this one. this can help a lot of people. In 2007, when I learned Primordial Sound Meditation at the Chopra Center, I've been suffering from a very common anxiety disorder, which a lot of people have, is called fear of flying.
Uh-huh.
And I never really feared flying until I had kids. And then some reason I just got this weird phobia. But I had to fly because I had relatives in France. And at that particular moment, we were living in France. And so I had to fly back to the U.S. But it was really anxiety provoking for me. It was terrible. And I was terrified and I wouldn't take medications for it, but I was just, it was awful. A week after learning meditation at this seminar in San Diego, I decided to use this meditation technique when I got onto the plane. And I just said, okay, I've got a 13-hour flight to Paris. I'm just going to meditate for those 13 hours. That's all I'm going to do. And, you know, I was literally having a panic attack before I walked onto the plane, literally. It was really bad. But I got onto the plane. I sat down in my seat. I meditated off and on for 13 hours. And never again have I had a fear of flying.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's powerful.
I mean, they show these accidents on the news. So like statistically, flying is relatively safe. But I mean, you are hurtling through space with in a flying tin can. So I mean, it's not an unreasonable fear.
And you know what? Like the fear of flying, in fear of anything really, is all about fear of loss of control, right? It's a control. So most people that have, and I was talking to somebody about this, like a client actually about this, and I was telling her, I was like, you know, fear is only for control freaks. That's it. Fear is for control freaks. So if you suffer from extreme anxiety, you're a control freak. You just need to get over it. I'm just saying that in tongue in cheek. I'm totally saying that tongue in cheek, you guys. I suffered from anxiety after I had my cancer at age 28. And like I told you, I was fearing flying. But meditation teaches you about relinquishing control. That's really what it's about. It's about surrender. It's about relinquishing control.
Thank you, Michelle. Well, we're just about out of time. We've been speaking with Michelle Fondin. She's the author of Chakra Healing for Vibrant Energy, exploring your seven energy centers with mindfulness, yoga, and Ayurveda. And you can find her at michellefondinauthor.com. Just before we wrap up, I'm wondering, what do you feel is the most important thing that you want to leave listeners with today?
You have your own inner healer within you. And through these practices, such as mindfulness, yoga, and eating clean, you can start to access your inner healer that will awaken for you. But just know that it's inside of you. You don't need to look for the answers outside of you.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And thank you for being with us today. I hope you have found value in our discussion. And I want to send you lots of love for a wonderful week. Be well. Namaste. Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
One of Victoria's best up-and-coming bands, Fortune Killers, is on tour with their debut album, Temper Temper. What I'm looking for is buried by design. Fortune Killers with Vancouver alt-rockers High Love play Guilt & Co. Tuesday, June 12th.
Three women, dressed in lingerie, were hanging from the ceiling on meat hooks. In an adjacent room, a man was in bed with two deceased females, also wearing lingerie. He positioned their arms in a sexy embrace. Down the hall, a man holding a chainsaw stood over the motionless body of a sixth woman, lying on a table covered in plastic. These are scenes from a popular music video by a Grammy Award-winning artist. If we want violence against women to stop, shouldn't we stop treating it like entertainment? Join the conversation at #NotOkay.
My name's Chris Arific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is without question the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it Monday
from 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
Break your fingers!
Wise Hall Fleet.
You are listening to 101.9